Take Latina USA and more with you on the NPR One app. NPR One finds you the best from public radio and beyond. Election essentials, local stories, and your favorite podcasts. NPR One is ready to make your driving, working, or cleaning the house better. Find NPR One on your app store.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Donald Trump, he changed absolutely everything when he said that Mexican immigrants were criminals, rapists, and drug traffickers. He didn't say some Mexican immigrants. And you have to remember, I am a Mexican immigrant. So he was talking about me. So it is personal.
That's veteran journalist Jorge Ramos. He's the television anchor for Univision's nightly news program, as well as for the Fusion Network. Jorge has worked as a journalist in the United States for three decades and is undoubtedly one of the most important Latino journalists in the United States. In August of last year, Jorge Ramos did something that some people saw as controversial, while others saw as courageous.
I confronted him in Iowa.
By him, Jorge means the man that he mentioned earlier, the candidate who has dominated mainstream news since his run for office began. That would be Donald Trump. Jorge Ramos went to a Trump press conference with a plan.
I looked for the place where I knew there was not going to be a lot of journalists. I made sure that I was going to be asking a question standing up and that I wasn't going to stop until I ended up my question, because he has a tendency to say, excuse me, and interrupt everything. And then he did what only Fidel Castro had done in the past. In other words, to use a bodyguard to prevent me from asking a question. He called a bodyguard and he ejected me from that press conference.
By now, you've probably seen the footage of Jorge Ramos at that press conference. But if you haven't, here's a recap. In Dubuque, Iowa, journalists are being called on to ask questions. Donald Trump calls on another journalist, and then Jorge Ramos stands up and interrupts.
You cannot deport 11 million people. You cannot.
Trump tells him to sit down because it wasn't his turn to ask a question.
I'm a reporter, and don't touch me, sir. Don't touch me, sir.
But when Jorge Ramos doesn't sit down, Trump's security removes him from the room.
You're very rude. It's not about you.
It's not about
get out of my country. Get out.
This is
not
about you. I'm a U.S. citizen, too.
Well, whatever. No, Univision, no. It's not about you.
When I read all the hate messages in social media, when I heard Trump telling me, go back to Univision, I'm thinking, this is happening to someone who's been on TV and I'm sort of protected because of TV. So just imagine if this is happening to me, what is going to happen to those who are not on TV, who are not protected by being visible? What's going to happen with the invisible ones?
That's when Jorge decided to set out and travel the country to talk to people on both sides of some of these race-based clashes. He filmed it all for his new documentary called Hate Rising. In the documentary, Jorge says that he sees dark times happening now in our country. And whether you agree with him or not, it's undeniable that there has been a shift in political rhetoric during this presidential election. More than in any other election in recent history, this one has dipped constantly into racially charged territory. Today, we're going to address that elephant in the room. We're going to talk openly about race and the crucial role that it's played in this election cycle. And the conversations that we're going to hear today are not always easy. They delve into the fabric of who we are as individuals and who we are as part of our country. But they're necessary, they're real, and sometimes they're uncomfortable. Now, back to Jorge Ramos and his documentary, Hate Rising, in which Jorge went to some places where he was clearly not wanted.
So let's take it back to one of the opening scenes. You're in Texas. It's nighttime, and we come upon a swastika that I guess has little light bulbs on it?
What's so ironic, it's Christmas light bulbs, yes.
So tell me a little bit about what happens in this interview.
The director of the film, Catherine Tambini, a U.S. citizen, she's the one who arranged that meeting with Rowdy, because he didn't want to say his real name. He's an imperial wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. Somewhere in Texas, I'm not allowed to say exactly where in Texas. And he had the impression that he was going to be talking to her, not to me. So we went all the way to this gathering of the KKK. And right before she was supposed to sit down with him, she moved and I sat down. if we would have told him that he was going to be talking to a Latino, to an immigrant, he would not have accepted that.
You don't believe that everyone is equal?
No, no. White people are so much higher than any other race.
Do you feel superior than me simply because I'm a Latino?
Oh, yeah. Sure do. I'm not saying you're a dumb, nothing like that.
No, but you think you're superior than me,
I think my race is better than your race.
Well, actually, Latino is not a race.
Well, whatever you want to call yourself.
He made a move sort of that he wanted to shake my hand, and he pulled it back. And then I realized this guy doesn't want to touch me. And that's the dimension of hate and hatred that you find in the United States. The number of chapters linked to the KKK grew from 72 to 190 in just 1 year. 20 people were killed by white supremacists last year. 63 mosques were attacked last year. So hate is rising.
What is different? I mean, you know, the KKK was born in Georgia, and they've been around for a long time.
What's different is Donald Trump, because he has allowed those voices that before only live on the internet and in secret gatherings to come out. And when he started attacking immigrants, Muslims, when he questioned the birthplace of the first African-American president in this country, when he had really confusing positions on David Duke, a former KKK leader, that was exactly what white supremacist groups wanted to hear. We have to understand, put it in context, that the rise of white supremacist groups started after President Barack Obama was elected. But then once Donald Trump was announced his candidacy, again, the spike on the number of hate groups increased.
In a pantheon of white heroes, Hitler towers above them all. Above them all.
When your daughters came home with their little mixed breed kids and you looked at it and you said, oh my God, it has my blood in it. You welcomed it into your home. You just lost the war.
I went to a KKK meeting with neo-Nazis and white supremacists in Ohio. And for 3 hours, I didn't say a word because the director of the film begged me not to say a word because I have an accent in English.
I was wondering what was going on. I was like, Jorge is there. He's watching all of this. And Jorge is sitting there silent.
Completely silent because it was very dangerous. They were armed. Some of them were drinking. They were about to burn a swastika.
So they didn't know who you were?
They had no idea who I was. They don't watch Univision, fortunately. And they thought I was just part of the crew. I spent my life asking questions, but I, just for survival, I stayed completely quiet.
You were able to speak with Guillermo Rodriguez, who is a Mexican immigrant in Boston who was attacked by two white men.
38-year-old Scott Leader and 30-year-old Stephen Leader accused of urinating on a sleeping homeless man on the sidewalk and then punching and beating him with a metal pole that he kept.
Donald Trump was right. All these illegals need to be deported. Trump's reaction?
I will say the people that are following are very passionate.
Is that true?
And here you ask Guillermo if he thinks the attack was political, and he actually says yes, that he thinks it was fueled by Trump.
He's a homeless man, by the way, a legal immigrant, working in Boston, making barely $5, $10, $15 a day, picking up cans. And Guillermo was brutally attacked simply because he was an immigrant. That's all. He didn't say anything.
And you know, when I was listening to the people who you spoke to have been victimized, and in particular to Guillermo, you know, what they're responding with is that I love this country, even though they were victims of a hate crime.
So, yes, we're seeing the worst that I've ever experienced in this country. But at the same time, there are incredible examples of generosity and solidarity.
There's a moment in the documentary where you make a trip to a school in Texas and you're meeting with a group of children, all of them who are Mexican-American and living in Texas.
Mr. Jorge Ramos, you've probably seen him on TV, right? And so today you have...
Can you tell us about that experience of being with the kids?
For the kids, it's real. It's the so-called Trump effect. When they hear about Trump, and just imagine the horror of 11 million people being deported. That means deporting 15,000 people every single day. And for them, when they hear about deporting people and building a wall, that means that maybe their parents won't be at home that night. That means that the grandma that takes care of him might be deported. So it's something real. And they're filled with fear and anxiety. And I never expected that. I thought this was going to be a conversation among adults, that kids were going to be kids and that they were not going to be concerned about
what
that.
What else have you heard from the news?
He only wants to be president before he can make all the people go where they're from.
He wants to make people go?
Yeah, go where they're from. Like, my mom's from Mexico, and now her family has to go over there to Mexico. That's what he wants.
Are you afraid that your family might be separated?
Yes.
Why?
Because my dad is from Mexico, and if Donald Trump wins, he's going back to Mexico, and we're going to be separated.
Well, my dad, too.
My mom.
I never expected kids to cry when hearing the word Donald Trump. It doesn't mean that he's just a candidate. For them, that means the real possibility of their families being completely destroyed and separated.
So what were you left with after you saw these kids in terms of the long-term effect of what you think that they might be living with?
I think with the kids, it's always the most difficult ones, because there was a moment when the kids were crying. I remember touching the back of one of the kids and telling him that it's going to be okay. And then I realized I couldn't say that everything's going to be okay. And that felt really bad. Hate is here, and the damage has been done. It doesn't mean that we won't be able to go back to a civilized society, but I think it's going to take many, many years to repair the damage that Donald Trump has done. Those voices that were contained, those voices of hate, are out in the open.
Jorge Ramos, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you. Gracias.
Thanks to Fernanda Chavarri for producing that segment. Coming up on Latino USA, we meet a group dedicated to memorializing victims of crimes committed by undocumented immigrants.
The first maneuver of any ethno-nationalist project is to portray foreigners as dangerous.
Stay with us. No te vayas. So before we get back to our program, I want to read you a note that we got from a recent new donor. His name is Christopher, and he hails from Georgia. And he writes to us, "Your broadcasts educate and move me. I confess that before your show, I was fairly ignorant of the lives of Latino Americans. I find myself reading articles to catch up and hopefully find a way to serve the greater community. I sincerely appreciate your commitment to telling these stories." Thank you so much, Christopher, for your support and for your note. And I'm hoping that you, dear listener, will join Christopher and become a supporter of Latino USA. Just go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. And maybe you'll consider making a monthly gift, because every single penny that you donate makes a big difference for us. And just one more quick favor, if you can go to iTunes to rate and review Latino USA, this helps new listeners to find us. So we're counting on you. Gracias.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And Independent Sector, holding its annual conference for over 1,000 changemakers and charitable sector leaders this November in Washington, D.C. Learn more at newfrontiers2016.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're talking about the elephant in the spin room, race and the 2016 election. Now, Donald Trump's way of talking about immigrants has become a lightning rod this election cycle. It's led to disgust from many voters, enthusiasm from other voters, and wall-to-wall coverage in the media, no pun intended. But Trump's rhetoric on immigrants didn't materialize out of thin air. Reporter David Noriega of BuzzFeed Media has spent a lot of time over the last year researching what he calls the anti-immigrant right. These are the groups that were out there talking about so-called deportation forces and the bad hombres way before Trump appeared on the scene. Our producer Marlon Bishop spoke to David about his reporting on one group in particular. It's a group that may have set the stage for Donald Trump. It's called the Remembrance Project.
Last October, BuzzFeed reporter David Noriega found himself in a windowless room at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. He was there for a press conference, but there wasn't much press to speak of.
I'm fairly certain that the only reporters there were me, a reporter from Breitbart, and a reporter from VDare, which is just really plainly white nationalist, anti-immigrant website.
In the back of the room, there were a series of posters hanging up on the wall. They make up something called the Stolen Lives Quilt.
It's basically these printed photographs of the faces of people who have been killed by undocumented immigrants with some information about them.
One by one, the families of those victims came up to the podium and spoke.
My son, Sergeant Brandon Mendoza, was killed on his way home from work.
As my son's body lay there, the driver of the truck was trying to flee.
And the face he had will stay imprinted with me forever.
He was in his senior year in high school in Pearland, Texas, and will forever be 18 years old.
The press conference was set up by an organization called the Remembrance Project. It's dedicated to bringing attention to the stories of Americans who have been killed by undocumented immigrants. And it advocates for the idea that illegal immigration is, quote, not a victimless crime. In practice, they find opportunities for bereaved families to publicize their stories, like at this press conference.
The person that struck me the most was Dan Golvach.
My name is Dan Golvach. I am the father of Spencer Golvach.
He is a sort of middle-aged guy who lives in Houston. He's a professional musician. He has sort of shaggy long hair. And his son, Spencer, who is a very promising young musician in the sort of Houston scene, was just really, like, when people call murders senseless, often it's a cliche. This was really just, I can't think of a more senseless crime. He was just stopped at his car at a stoplight, and a guy who was basically on this unhinged shooting spree, just, he shot, you know, two or three other people in the same night. He just came up and shot Spencer, Dan's son, in the head while he was at the stoplight. And the way that Dan Golvach talked about this was really, there was a lot of power to it.
He was this warm, cuddly, giggly, beautiful little boy, and he grew into a real man. And he was my best friend.
The stories were moving for David, but something about the whole event stuck out for him. They weren't in some church meeting hall. They were in Washington, D.C., in a press room. It seemed to be about more than grief. It also seemed to be very much about politics.
They weren't killed by immigrants. They were murdered by a foreign invader, and they were nurtured by our government.
And how your elected officials are not listening to you and not voting and not doing the things that we are asking.
When is our government coming out of the shadows to protect its own?
We become second-class citizens in America.
Then I gotta thank my personal hero, Mr. Donald Trump.
The Remembrance Project is officially nonpartisan. But what David Noriega saw at the press conference appeared to him to be part of a specific political strategy to connect the issue of immigration with these terrible stories of violent crime, even though the studies strongly suggest that immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than those born in the U.S. It was a strategy that in many ways would come to define the presidential campaign of Donald Trump. And so David decided to look into the story of the Remembrance Project to see what it could tell us about the political moment we're living in. The group is run by a Houston-based woman named Maria Espinoza. I reached out to her on five occasions for this story, but never heard back. But at the press conference, David was able to speak to her about her story. Espinoza's mother was a fifth-generation Texan.
Her father, a Mexican immigrant, who, she makes a point to say, came to the country legally.
She, up until the point that she started the Remembrance Project, lived, I think, a pretty ordinary life. She worked as a paralegal for a long time. She has a family. She was a single mom for a while.
Espinoza told David that she began seeing things taking place in the country that she felt weren't right. It seemed to her that immigrants were getting benefits that they didn't deserve, while American citizens were struggling. Then in 2006, a big news story broke in Houston about a local police officer who had been killed by an undocumented Mexican man. This spurred Espinoza into action. Over the next few years, she started reaching out to families of similar crimes and finding platforms for them to talk about their stories. And thus, the Remembrance Project was born. In 2012, she went on a national tour with the Stolen Lives quilt in tow, visiting state capitals around the country and meeting with lawmakers.
That seems to have drawn a lot of attention, specifically from a constellation of nativist organizations that have access to some degree of funding. And once she was on their radar and started establishing connections with them, that kind of kicked her up to the next level.
The organizations David is talking about often describe themselves as in favor of low immigration or reduced immigration. Their opponents often refer to them collectively as the organized anti-immigrant or nativist movement. Whatever you call them, they're groups that are dedicated to advocating for much more restricted immigration policies than the ones we have now.
As most, if not all, of the organized nativist movement in the U.S. is really, it's pretty easy to draw a circle around it. A lot of it connects back to, you know, not just the same organizations, but the same guy.
That guy is John Tanton. Tanton was once described by Fox News analyst Linda Chavez as, quote, the most influential unknown man in America. He's an 81-year-old ophthalmologist from Michigan who, over the last four decades, has quietly laid the infrastructure for the anti-immigration movement. He was involved in starting almost all of the biggest organizations that fight for less immigration, including Numbers USA and FAIR, among many others. He's also been a controversial figure at times. A New York Times profile from 2011 laid out a history of racist statements expressed by Tanton in memos and private correspondence, including concerns about maintaining European-American society and culture, and about a coming Latin onslaught. One of Tanton's organizations, FAIR, raised controversy in the 90s for accepting money from a fund that was connected to an American eugenicist who inspired the Nazis. A request for comment about these controversies was not returned by Tanton. In 2014, the Remembrance Project received a $25,000 gift from one of Tanton's organizations, called U.S. Inc., according to tax filings. It should be noted that Maria Espinoza, in an email to reporter David Noriega, rejected the suggestion that she has any white nationalist ties, pointing out that as a Latina by ethnicity, she is not white. Anyway, in 2014, the Remembrance Project gets this $25,000 gift.
Then they're really poised to jump on the Trump moment, right? They have funding, they have a network, they're connected to, existing political organizations, and they're really ready to sort of have their moment in the sun.
You know what? Name your child and come right by. Go ahead.
Laura Wilkerson, and my son was Joshua Wilkerson. He was murdered by an illegal in 2010, and I personally support Mr. Trump for our next president.
In short order, the Remembrance Project went from small-town Tea Party meetings to the country's biggest political stages. Maria and the families became a frequent presence at Trump rallies. They were featured in Trump ads.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
The man who murdered Joshua is an illegal alien.
Maria appeared on cable television to defend
Trump. As a Latina and conservative Hispanic woman, I certainly stand with Mr. Trump. He is for laws.
And in July, three bereaved parents who had been affiliated with the Remembrance Project spoke on one of the biggest political stages of all, the RNC.
We need to secure our borders so no other person has to ever go through this kind of grief, pain and agony, knowing this could have been prevented. Build the wall, and Americans need to come first. Thank you.
What the Remembrance Project does is take these true and heartbreaking stories and ends up using them as weapons against all immigrants.
This is Lindsay Schubiner from the Center for New Community, a pro-immigrant advocacy group that fights what it calls organized bigotry.
But in each of the stories, the acts of violence have nothing to do with a person's immigration status. they're part of broader problems in our society, and we have to address them as a society rather than blaming immigrants.
And Schubiner says that the way the Remembrance Project uses these stories is very intentional.
And it's really a strategy of the organized anti-immigrant movement to increase nativist sentiment among their base. And as they gain platform, particularly over the past election cycle, to increase nativist sentiment among the American public more broadly.
I also called up Jessica Vaughn from the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank with a, quote, low immigration focus. She, unsurprisingly, views the Remembrance Project differently.
The Remembrance Project does serve an important purpose. First of all, is a way for the people who've been affected tragically in this way to share their stories and to let policymakers know that illegal immigration is not a harmless, benign phenomenon.
In any case, linking immigrants to crime in political rhetoric didn't start with Trump. And it didn't start with the Remembrance Project either.
I mean, there are endless examples of various sort of new immigrant populations throughout the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries being demonized in these very specific terms as criminals, as murderers, as drunks, as rabble-rousers, what have you.
Linking immigrants to crime isn't new, but it is effective. The kinds of stories the Remembrance Project promotes has likely helped push formerly fringe ideas, such as mass deportation and repealing birthright citizenship, into the center of the national conversation. And after spending a long time reporting on this, David Noriega understands why it's been so effective. He goes back to the story of Dan Golvach, the shaggy-haired Houston musician who told the story of his son's murder at the Remembrance Project presser last October.
When I talked to Dan, he was just, to him, it was common sense. It was this horrible thing that happened. What could we possibly do to make it not happen again, to make it not happen to other people? I mean, it's really just grief. That's exactly where the emotional power of the Remembrance Project comes from, right? It's one of the most just chemically, physically powerful feelings that a human being can feel.
Funneling grief towards political ends isn't new either. It happens whenever there's a mass shooting or a terrorist attack. But what Maria Espinoza and the Remembrance Project figured out is that it could be used in the battle over immigration policy as well. If Trump's talk on immigration is the fire, grief is the gasoline.
Thanks to Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop and to BuzzFeed Media's David Noriega for that story. Now, we here at Latino USA are no strangers to difficult conversations around race. We often get listener comments like this.
NPR's Latino USA, why can't this kind of news just be labeled news? Why can't you put it on NPR Caucasian?
And this week, we got an email that said,
why are you guys so racist?
We even get questions about whether a show called Latino USA should even exist. So we wanted to have a conversation about this, and we reached out to someone who can sympathize, Gene Demby.
That was one of the things we used to get all the time. Like, you know, I mean, we still get, you know, we have a public email. We still get emails that are like, you know, this race thing would go away if you would stop.
Gene Demby is the lead blogger for Code Switch, NPR's race, ethnicity, and culture blog. Code Switch is also a podcast, and Gene is one of the hosts. The perception could be that we are, you know, again, in air quotes, that we're inherently racist.
Clearly what's going on for a lot of people is, okay, so for a long time, white people got to be the default, and they didn't have to have any sort of qualifiers in front of their, you know, I'm just a person.
But today the conversation has evolved, and white people are being talked about in racial terms, which is new for many of them.
They are uncomfortable. They're made uncomfortable by it.
In today's political landscape, a lot of people find the mere mention of race to be offensive. Here's a clip of Tucker Carlson on Fox News discussing a clip of President Barack Obama giving the commencement speech at Howard University, which is a historically black college in Washington, D.C.
Be confident in your heritage. Be confident in your blackness.
See, this is divisive. If Mitt Romney had won and in the last year of his presidency went to BYU and said, be confident in your whiteness, people would say, whoa. Yeah. Why are you making this why are you encouraging people to think in terms of their race? Isn't that inherently divisive? Shouldn't people think in terms of their Americanness, in terms of the qualities that unite us all, not in terms of their immutable characteristics? Would Martin Luther King have said that? I don't think so.
I just hate that we have to, like, pretend all the time that these things are equivalent, right? Like, it's not. The thing about when people say stuff like that is they always sort of pretend that history just started, like, you know, in 2008. You know what I mean? Like, that America just began when Obama became president. I mean, Shireen Marisol Meraji, my colleague on Code Switch, actually just did a story when she went to Montana and talked to a bunch of white voters. And some of them are like, you know, this race stuff is Obama's fault. Like, we never thought about this stuff before, which is, you know, remarkable. But also, like, you know, I think there's a lot of sort of feigned, like Tucker Carlson is sort of like feigning ignorance there. Right. I mean, because, you know, obviously, like, part of the reason Obama has to say that, and this is the whole like Black Lives Matter thing, is like implicitly, for a long period in history, if you were Black or Latino in this country, you were made to feel bad about yourself.
Part of what makes a show like Code Switch or Latino USA so unique is that we tell stories, news, and history from a kind of perspective. And this might make people uncomfortable, like Gene said. But for a long time, and still often today, there are a lot of assumptions about reporting about people of color.
I mean, one of the things we've done actually is try to actually point out the ways that we are not objective, right? Like, not that we are specifically objective as brown people doing journalism, but the way that white journalists are not objective too, right? I mean, so many of the stories that we've read over the last, you know, 40, 50 years of American journalism about people of color has been written by white people. And, like, so they frame that conversation in a lot of ways that, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people, you know, have feelings about this, but, like, you know, and sometimes those stories are really anthropological. You know, we joke about this on Code Switch all the time, but, like, whenever there's a story about black people, it was like some white reporter would go to a church or a barbershop. You know what I mean? Like, there was this thing that this sort of assumptions and presumptions about, like, what the spectrum of conversation looked like in communities of color, that I think we are finally seeing some real pushback on.
So, is bringing up race racist? Clearly, we don't think so. In fact, it's often our duty as journalists to talk about things that are true, even if they're uncomfortable. But the word race has acquired a different weight to it, especially in this election, as race politics have taken center stage. My thanks to Gene Demby and to the entire Code Switch team for talking to us about the work that we do. And coming up on Latino USA,
the kind of jobs that have been lost, as physically demanding as they were, gave some people a sense of pride. You know, you don't hear a lot of country music songs about people working at the McDonald's.
How the American dream, or lack of it, has affected white people in the U.S. suburbs, and what this says about our changing nation. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Hey, before we get back to the show, the NPR Politics podcast is counting down to Election Day, with new episodes every day. They'll have new podcast episodes every afternoon, so you'll know what happened and what it means. Whatever your routine, make the NPR Politics podcast a part of it, every day now through November 9th, because we're all going to wake up and wonder what just happened. Subscribe or listen on the NPR One app. Okay, back to the show.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grantmaking and social investing. More at kresge.org. And Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So far, we've been talking about how race has been a central player in this year's presidential election. But to truly understand its role, we also have to understand something that we, as a society, don't normally talk about: whiteness.
It's always been really hard to pin down legal definitions of whiteness. Usually it has to do with not being black or how much black can be in white. So white is kind of this vague, floating concept.
That's historian Nell Irving Painter. And that quote that you just heard was featured on a podcast we've been following. It's called The United States of Anxiety. It's produced here in New York by WNYC, and it tackles how anxiety is a dominating theme in this election, from the economy to national security to what it means to be an American in the 21st century. The podcast brings the voices of people trying to hold on to the American dream while speaking to others looking to build their own American dream. And it does so by looking into the communities on Long Island, an area near New York City with shifting economic and racial demographics. Race has been an undertone of many episodes from the podcast. And in a recent one, it delved into not only the definition of whiteness, but how that's been tied to success and economic mobility. This idea is something that WNYC reporter Jim O'Grady has looked into, and he's here with us in this studio. Hey, Jim.
Hi, it's great to be here.
All right, so in the segment that we're about to hear, you really looked at whiteness, but essentially from a different focus, and you're a white guy.
I am a white guy.
Born and bred. So what was the focus that you looked at?
We wanted to go to a place in Long Island that was not the Hamptons. That was a place that you drive past and you barely consider.
So the Hamptons are kind of like a very wealthy vacation area that very wealthy New Yorkers go to.
Yeah, Long Island in general is known for its prosperity. But there are large parts of it where people are working class and middle class, and some of those people are struggling.
So we're going to listen now to your reporting. You went to Suffolk County. You went with this guide, Chris Arnotti. He's a writer and a photographer who has been chronicling the Trump country for years. In fact, some would say even before it had a name. And just a note, there's a word that some of you might find offensive in this story, and we've bleeped it, so you've been warned.
Chris Arnotti is a former bond trader with a PhD in particle physics. He used to be a quant, a guy who uses higher math to get an edge on the market. You heard about quants if you watched the movie The Big Short.
That's my quant.
Your what?
My quantitative. My math specialist. Look at him.
Arnotti says he couldn't look at himself in good conscience when the economy crashed in 2008.
B's, zero. Double B's, zero. Triple B's, zero. And then that happens.
What is that?
That's America's housing market.
So Arnotti quit his job and moved with his family from their condo in Brooklyn Heights to New Paltz, near some woods with coyotes. He's Catholic, so he's been trying to atone by going to the places in America that his Wall Street math helped wreck. What he's found can be boiled down to a phrase.
There's a sense of economic anxiety and a sense of kind of having been kicked in the
In 2015, he landed a writing assignment from the Atlantic magazine to drive around the country.
Just talking to Americans about the American dream.
He put 20,000 miles on his Honda Odyssey.
Binghamton, New York, Kingsport, Tennessee.
He keeps a mattress in the back so he can car camp in Walmart parking lots. It's a thing. You can Google it.
Floyd County, Kentucky, Buffalo, New York, Selma, Alabama.
Arnotti figured out it's a good idea to put a leather-bound book next to the driver's seat that says Holy Bible. It has a calming effect on policemen and strangers, especially in the South. He stashes his prized possession, his interview notes, between the pages of the book, because no one ever messes with it.
I think that direction's better.
Okay.
Because that
he and I are taking a road trip to the plainer side of Suffolk, the towns you bypass on your way out to the Hamptons.
Now you're getting kind of Jimmy's Diner, you're getting kind of
places like Mastic and Shirley and Center Moriches.
Pizza, karate, tanning, drywall.
This looks a little more kind of my territory.
His territory is the large and overlooked middle zones between dynamic downtowns and tourist destinations, places crippled by the recession and pummeled by the changing economy, as he found on his reporting trip.
The first person I talked to was in a small upstate New York town that once had industry, but now the only jobs there now were guiding tourists who came to do trout fishing. They would stock the river. And the guy, I asked him, you know, about the American dream, and his response was, American dream's broken. I mean, it's gone.
Upstate New York once had factories owned by bedrock firms like IBM and Kodak, Corning and Carrier, a company that this year alone laid off hundreds of workers.
He said, this town used to make things. Now all we do is we cater to tourists who come here to fish our rivers with fish that we don't even have. We put the fish in the river for them to catch.
Arnotti says over and over he's run into a side effect that comes with the switch from blue-collar jobs that take muscle to service jobs that don't. Emasculation.
You know, there's this guy in Prestonburg, Kentucky, who I'll never forget. I was there for a week, and I spent most of my time in the Walmart Plaza. It's a small town, so he saw me all my time. He knew what I was doing. I asked him, you know, about his job, and he kept saying, it's a paycheck. That was it. I don't like it, but it's a paycheck. And that's the attitude. It's, you know, this isn't me. I'm more than this. His grandfather, his father was a coal miner, and he stocked shelves at a supermarket. And he wasn't proud of it, to be honest. I mean,
we're on the Long Island Expressway, not far from Bethpage, home to Northrop Grumman. This is the company that built World War II Hellcat fighter planes and the first lunar module.
Listen, Vanguard Base here. The Eagle has landed.
In the 1980s, Grumman employed as many as 80,000 people. 99% of those jobs are gone. 850 cut as recently as 2 years ago. Grumman no longer builds airplanes on Long Island. An argument is raging right now about whether the deep sense of grievance among Trump voters is legitimate, economic hardship, or illegitimate. Racism, xenophobia, misogyny. Arnotti says all of that mixed together, plus something else. The feeling among a lot of the white working class that they've become targets of mockery, the goofballs in the back row of the classroom.
One of the pernicious, is that a word, pernicious?
It is.
One of the pernicious, that means bad, right?
Do you want to spell it?
The idea is it's a meritocracy that consequently, if you don't make it, it's your fault. You know, you just didn't study hard enough or you're stupid. And that's a phrase that a lot of people, I find extremely offensive, is when they categorize a group of voters as being dumbs or stupid.
Earlier this year, when big-name political writers like Jonathan Chait were calling Trump voters, quote, complete idiots, Arnotti published an essay in The Guardian under the headline, Why Trump Voters Are Not Complete Idiots. We pull off Montauk Highway to stop at one of the area's ubiquitous roadside hot dog stands. This one has a large sign with the image of the flag and the caption, Proud to be an American. Up walks Connie.
Connie Napolitano.
Born in Brooklyn.
Greenpoint section.
Was it good growing up there?
Oh, great. Not today, but when I was there, yeah. I'm out here 46 years.
Where? What town?
Shirley.
Greenpoint used to be great, but not today. Like America. Connie says she and her husband, Fiore, moved to Long Island in 1970 to escape the crime in Brooklyn and raise their seven children, all of them grown now.
They all got houses. They all got good jobs.
So technically, the Napolitanos have achieved the American dream. Still, she worries.
But I'm worried about this president, about what's going to happen here.
What's worrying you about it?
I don't like either one of them, but I'd rather see Trump get in rather than Hillary Clinton.
Why is that?
I think he knows more what to do with money and about the war. What does she know about the war? She don't know nothing.
I start to ask about race and immigration, but she cuts me off.
Go talk to my husband in a truck. He'll talk to you better than I will.
Okay. Hey.
How we doing?
She said you have opinions.
Yeah, about this country?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? It's going down the tubes.
It's going down the tubes. Why?
Look what's happening in this country.
First of all the jobs are leaving, number one. Everything is made out of plastic, no more metal. And bring back the steel industry. I mean, there's a million things. The kids can't do nothing with their hands no more.
The loss of manual labor is a big deal to Fiore. He's retired after working 40 years as a mechanic.
I was a truck mechanic for one of the largest companies in the world.
In where?
Smith Freight in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Smith Freight.
No.
Spectre.
Oh, Spectre Freight.
S-P-E-C-T-E-R.
You got me.
Spectre Freight in Brooklyn.
You got the wrong guy. To how do you write my name, Silver? I got more brains in my little thumb than people. You know, I had no schooling, no education, but I could straighten out this country, I would say, halfway at least.
Fiore doesn't trust Hillary and is no fan of President Obama.
Obama talks for 8 years. He didn't do nothing.
He tells Arnotti and I that he likes Trump.
I want to ask you a question that, don't take it the wrong way, but
no.
A lot of people say Trump is a racist. What do you think to that?
I think everybody's racist.
You know what? There's good and bad in black. There's good and bad in white. There's good and bad in Hispanic. Nobody's better than anybody else.
I have an old gentleman, old coal miner, and he lost his arm almost and just took the blood from the color guy. A Negro man saved his life. Okay? I have a Puerto Rican friend of mine. He is so close, he's my brother. He's a millionaire, this guy. I'd never pose on him, but he would be there for me if I needed it. Now, he's Puerto Rican, and believe me, I'll stand in the way of bullet to him.
We say goodbye, but Fiore stops us to reveal that while he'll vote for Trump, his ideal candidate is another man.
Well, my candidate, they're going to laugh if I tell you, is John Wayne. Okay? He ain't there no more. Okay? He ain't there no more.
John Wayne, the legendary cowboy actor.
If he ever catch you burning the American flag, you better hope to God he don't kill you.
The Duke. Not a man who guides finance guys to the local trout stream. A man who saves widows in the West and kicks ass on Omaha Beach. A father figure who could retrieve our mythic past.
Face the flag, son, and face reality. Our strength and our freedoms are based in unity. Flag is but a symbol, son.
Arnotti and I get back in the Honda and, you know, because we're members of the media elite, we eat knishes with mustard as we drive back to the city. He says Fiore's lament about the changing nature of work is familiar to him from his travels.
The kind of jobs that have been lost, as physically demanding as they were, gave some people a sense of pride. You know, you don't hear a lot of country music songs about people working at the McDonald's or being a greeter at Walmart or stocking shelves at Walmart.
Songs like Alabama's 40-Hour Week.
Hello, Pittsburgh, steel mill worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living, just to send it on down the line.
What's driving so much of what's going on is the need for pride, the feeling of being humiliated.
This is for the one who swings the hammer.
Pittsburgh played a central role in building our nation. But our workers' loyalty was repaid, you know it better than anybody, with total betrayal.
Once somebody feels humiliated, they will do most anything to try to, A, get revenge, or B, find a way to get pride back. And I think Trump, he's selling them a scam of cheap pride. This is a cheap way to feel included. This is a cheap way to get back at the world that's wronged you.
Don't worry, we're bringing it all back. Don't worry about it, okay? Don't worry.
With a spirit you can't replace with no machine. Hello, America.
All right, Jim. So there's this idea that what makes Trump successful amongst non-college educated whites is essentially that they're being sold, like Chris Arnotti said, this scam of cheap, easy pride in a way. What did you understand about this?
When I think about that, I think about the guy in upstate New York who talks about this zone that used to be thriving with companies and their factories, and now they're virtually all gone. And one of the things this guy does to get by is guiding people to rivers and streams in the area that are stocked with fish. And sometimes his clients are the very Wall Street guys engineering the change in the economy that caused these businesses to be lost. So imagine you're this guy having to defer to and laugh at the bad jokes of these sort of masters of the economic universe as you take them to the rivers stocked with fish for them. That, to me, is legitimate. That sense of almost despair that can lead to anger is there. And it's not going away after the election and needs to be dealt with somehow.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about the white vote that is supporting Donald Trump?
There is a mix of motives behind the white vote supporting Donald Trump. There are malign motives, especially given our racial history in this country, misogyny, nativism. But also in there, there is a legit gripe about the changing nature of work in America and about the loss of identity and especially pride. So the way Chris explained it, he's a former Wall Street guy himself, is when you're down in the market, you want volatility. You want things to change no matter what, because then you at least have a chance of having a better prospect for yourself. And there's no bigger agent of volatility than Donald Trump.
Jim O'Grady, thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria.
And so a final thought about the conversation of race and the 2016 presidential election. Make sure that your voice is heard, even and especially in the uncomfortable conversations. And that's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Nadia Raymond, Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Chavarri, Antonia Cerejido, Ginny Montalvo, Julia Hsu, Zakia Gibbons, and Noam Hassenfeld. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McBoiler. Our intern is Catherine Gonzalez. Our office coordinator is Mariko Gwynn. And special thanks this week to Jorge Ramos, BuzzFeed Media, WNYC, Colin Ashmead Bobbitt, and WBEZ in Chicago. And if you enjoyed the music that you heard on this episode and you want to learn more, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Instagram. Until the next time, hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Boom!
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org. And the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare students for a lifetime of opportunity by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA.
I wasted a lot of time on the loves of my life. You know, I think about what I could have done with that time. You know, I could have learned Urdu. I could be a belly dancer now.
On election week, a palate cleanser, an intimate conversation with a legend of Latino literature, Sandra Cisneros. That's next time on Latino USA.